Welcome to our sermon series again, 2 Corinthians. Turn the corner in chapter 10, as you heard in that short video clip, and enter the final straight. And as we noted earlier in the series, Paul may well be travelling at this stage and writing parts of this letter at different times and different places. There are many attempts to explain why the letter chops and changes in these last chapters. But we've heard before in this series about Paul's battle by correspondence, if you like, with a troop of religious leaders who are diluting, or at worst, denying the gospel of Jesus that is Paul's message and Paul's life. And there at Corinth, there in Europe and Greece, among the Christians in a church that Paul has had the privilege of establishing and nurturing through his ministry on his journey. And here in chapter 10, if you've got your Bible that you came in, you might like to turn to 2 Corinthians 10. I'm not going to take you through verse by verse today. We're going to do something different. Paul is contending again for the hearts of some Christians at Corinth who are opting for a softer, more palatable gospel, if you like, or religion that actually kind of is attuned to the way of life in Corinth, where wealth, health, and status are the gods, entwined in the religious practices of the Greco-Roman world in that very prosperous city. From the previous chapters, we've talked about that collection he's making for poorer Christians in Jerusalem. Now it turns back to this topic of contending with some Christians at Corinth whose hearts have been stolen away by a group of religious leaders who've come in late with some other message that they purport to be about Jesus. So because we've looked at this before in the series, apologies to those who are with us just for today, but you can look back in our sermon series if you're interested. I thought we'd do something different and think about how Paul's statement in chapter 10, which reintroduced this theme, might interact with our world today. You know, we look back on Paul, he's kind of one of the first apologists for the gospel. With the conflicts within the church and kind of morphing through into the marketplace in Corinth, Paul has to defend his own apostleship as legitimate. And he seeks to defend the news about Jesus that he proclaimed. You heard Greg read to us from Mark's Gospel, chapter 6. Wouldn't you prefer to kind of learn about Jesus from someone who's kind of experienced who he is and what he's done? Those people who were recipients of Jesus' grace and ministry. Or would you prefer to be with someone who likes to commodify and make religious some theoretical teaching about Jesus? Paul says, I'm going to contend for your heart. And he likens it, if you look at chapter 10 and the first five verses, to a kind of battleground of mind and heart, which his letter is arguing for, passionately and clearly. So I thought today I'd ask someone in the congregation what it's like to try and represent the gospel humbly, passionately and clearly today in the world we live in, where health, wealth and status are all still pretty much kings, aren't they? And Paul had a different way, different weapons, divinely authorised and humbly and meekly fashioned. How would we go about defending Christianity when it's denied or diluted today, either in the marketplace or sadly in the church itself? So I thought I'd just randomly ask, I've prepared someone in the congregation to come forward and in conversational style. Alan Nichols is going to do that with us this morning. We're going to have a chat up the front. So let's have a chat now. Do I need to turn on a microphone? Is this a hard chat?
Thought it might be.
You are? Well, this is Alan. Some of you have met him over coffee or tea or over some political matter that he might talk to you about at some time. But in a different life, he had all sorts of titles and roles in the church, but we'll talk about that along the way. 2 Corinthians, we've been chatting about. And Alan, I wonder if we start by saying, what strikes you when you're reading 2 Corinthians about how some of those Corinthian Christians we heard about in the last couple of sermons had made promises but did not keep them?
Some of this is about risk taking, and Steve taking a large risk giving me a microphone. That's the first thing. Well, we're not on a battleground here, no. This is peaceful at St. Michael's. One of the things that occurs to me, because the Corinthians chapters are quite awkward when you read them, you think things are a bit out of proportion here. It's about a collection. They talk about it in Corinth, but they don't do it. They don't send it. He's been there twice and talked to them about it, and it's still not getting anywhere. The theme I want to pick out of that is that they talk a lot in Corinth, but they don't act. And it seems to me the environment of Corinth is a bit like the environment of Australia. That is, church leaders, representatives, these are super apostles after all, talk a lot, but they don't actually do it. They don't even fulfill their commitment to send money to rescue the poor Christians in Jerusalem. So you can read some of this as a battleground, yes, and that is for the leading Christians to take their commitment seriously and to act on it and stop talking about it.
Yeah, well, I talk a lot, and you tell me I do. But you tell me to act. So that's good. It's great to have a congregation members who say, do something. And we will. That's what this sermon series is going to do. Do you want to say something more?
I do.
Yeah, good.
Unfortunately, he's going to have the last word at the end of the sermon.
No, not much.
Because I don't know how to do that. The other thing is the risk taking, I think. And that's part of the battleground idea. Paul is inviting people to take risks. He's done it himself. We saw it all on the screen. He's been this super apostle himself. But he then says, of course, I'm really humble and I don't really depend on those things. He's in the battleground. They are not the Corinthians in the battleground. And that's part of the battleground of ideas. And from my point of view, some of the things I've done were I was unprepared for. Things just happen. You get invited to do something, or you take on a task and it gets bigger. One of mine was when I was working with the Jesuit Refugee Service and got involved in the civil war between Myanmar, or Burma as it was then, and the Karen ethnic minority group. It's a whole story, I won't elaborate. But I do have a photo, in case at any point over coffee people want to check my authentic life story. I have a photo of me in a bunker in Burma with the civil war going on. They promised me it would stop, and it didn't stop. I was there at the invitation of the Prime Minister of the Karen, Sobhan Kim, to talk about the displaced people and how we could, from Jesuit Refugee Service, provide funds and support and medical care and so on. So I was there for a good purpose. It all went wrong, and I finished up in a bunker watching the war with the shells going over where I was and landing across the river in Thailand. The Thais weren't happy with this, but I wasn't happy with it either. But if you want evidence, there's my evidence of a bunker. The thing is risk-taking. In order to try and fulfil our commitment to the refugees in that situation, we took risks, and I took the risk of getting in a boat, racing up the river, and then going to what was supposed to be shelter and safety, and then discovering it wasn't at all, and I had to be rescued and got out of there. Curiously, a lot of international journalists and film crews were there because they wanted to be in the front line of the Civil War and get their pictures. which is fine, but I was the only person that was rescued by the Karen leadership, and they left all the journalists there looking for somewhere to hide and protect themselves. So that was just a little sideline. Later in a, I was going to say a pub, I can't say that, later in a meeting place on the border where the international journalists used to all go because they spoke English, they saw me there and said, how come they rescued you and not us? I said, no, no. It's a secret, I can't tell you. These are big issues. But it has all these implications, and that risk we were taking, we had no idea that that would occur. But it is part of the commitment of that agency we're working with to commit to those people and help rescue them and help, well, in that sense, a genuine battleground.
Now, back home in less dangerous circumstances, you often say to me that when you introduce yourself to someone down the street, or, you know, one of the shops near where you live, or people you meet at a party, given all the titles and various
I don't go to parties. What's this party business?
I've been to parties.
If there's something in St. Michael's I haven't heard about.
People say to you inevitably, Alan, what do you do? And you curiously often lead with, I'm a writer. You rarely say, I'm a priest. Now, in my experience, you've always been more of a writer than a priest, so that's just you and me. But you would say,
I'll forgive you over the period.
You would say, I'm a writer. Why would you do that? With all the kind of background you've got, Archdeacon of Melbourne, you once came back to Archbishop, you've been on these committees and boards, you say, I'm a writer. Why that when you make
someone?
Isn't that a bit
disingenuous? Well, the answer is a bit obvious. That is, to identify as a priest these days is not very acceptable. And if you're not careful, it goes straight into the discussion about child abuse. Now, of course, we all have to admit the extent to which we did or didn't do something. I was running for Mr. James from St. John's for 8 years, and this was a real risk all the time in the professional conduct of that operation, especially with the family abuse and conflict situations. There's a constant tension all the time. And then when you see what's happened in other parts of Australia, particularly in the church, it's very depressing. The work people put into all of that, and then not just disappointment, the sense of treachery and betrayal, really, of some church leaders who failed away from they should have. So it's so uncomfortable situation. You have them if you have to, but you avoid them if you can. Which is why I don't say to people I'm a priest. I say I'm a writer. Sometimes I say I'm a refugee worker, depending on how the brain works. So I have been a writer. I was a journalist originally. I was a crime reporter in a newspaper in Sydney. And that prepared me a lot for the conflicts that happen in society, the damage people do to one another, and how some restorative things can be done to either rescue people or repair things. But of the 21 books I have written, which I don't generally talk about, or the number of books, but I'll answer the question if you ask me how many have been published, but of the 21, the one that's best known is the David Penman a biography, which I did after David died, and which became a necessary thing in the conversations going on in the church at the time. That went into a number of footprints, and people still kind of remember that. So that's part of the way of saying, genuinely, I'm a writer, then I talk about the other things if I have to.
Now, you do write quite actively in all sorts of ways, and you actually write letters to the editor in The Age,
My weapon is committees. This may surprise you.
Mm-hmm.
Partly because I was in the welfare business from 78 to 1996, and after that on various committees, DCOS and ACOS and all of that world of welfare. I came to the attention of governments, particularly the Victorian government, and I started serving on committees at their invitation. I was never asked to be a church representative. I was invited as a person in ethics, and some of my writing is in that area, or as a consumer. So it was one category or the other. It's a total of 34 years altogether that I've served on government committees, which is a bit of a surprise. The Infertility Treatment Authority was really important because it was how IVF became legalised and then how some changes were made to it. I was on the Social Justice Consultative Council of the Premier, a number of different things, some at the same sort of time. Now, here is the battleground of ideas. Public servants, politicians, community people being involved in searching for the common good, really, you'd say. Trying to define what is the common good for Christians and then how it applies. And some of those tasks on government committees proved very taxing and very interesting. Peter MacCallum Hospital, I was deputy chair of that for 9 years and chair of the research committee. And that saw the idea of the contest of ideas. Some were ethical ideas, some were accountability ideas, some were gender questions. And all of those I found terrifically interesting. Did it have results? Well, I have tried to calculate it when I finished my last committee 2 years ago, which was a cancer survivorship committee. Try to calculate what did this mean. One thing was you meet people who have very similar ideas about ethics and about the common good. And increasingly the common good kept coming up, often discussions led by other Christians as well, who could see there is a benefit here that can be made available more broadly to the community. But that could be a contest of ideas on committees between different advocacy groups. Have I covered that?
Yes, I think so.
Otherwise, I'll keep talking.
No,
I just realised.
There's a range of ways instead of just talking, you've acted, but at the same time, you've been one of those in those communities, not in some way,
yes.
Some figurehead or some title or some leader. You've been engaged with the community around you in this kind of apologetics that I'm talking about in action. I think I'll move on to this last section. Some of our...
Can I say another book?
Yeah.
Oh, I forgot something.
Yeah.
To show another book. Making Babies, this book's on.
Oh, yeah.
Test Tube and Christian Ethics became a really, early in the IVF debates in Australia, became a very important tool different people were using. And it became, that one is easy to track, the effect of this on the law, and then changes to the law to increase availability and eligibility into the IVF program. That had big impact on some people.
Mm.
So you could see sometimes how the particular work had a direct impact on the results in legislation.
To talk about the surprise when in that IVF program you stood for something that they thought you would have no interest in.
Just a few years ago, because IVF goes back to 1980, but just about 4 years ago, 3 years ago, I was still on the Ethics Committee of the In Vitro Fertilisation Authority, and the question came up, which became very controversial, about lesbian single women having access to IVF to the whole process. Or single women who may not have been part of the advocacy of the lesbian crowd, which was pretty active in those years. This is pretty tricky because it was assumed by the rest of the authority that I would obviously oppose this. I would oppose it because they're lesbians, and I'd oppose it because it meant that you could have a baby brought up by two women. So I consulted the University of Melbourne, a particular faculty that was doing special research in this area, and they had demonstrated that children brought up in a single parent household do not necessarily suffer. They may, but they may not necessarily suffer. And that the primary principle of the IVF legislation, which was written into the legislation, not just part of the debate, was the common good of the child, the best interests of the child that may be born through IVF, it must be the presiding, overcoming principle. On that basis, I decided to support the access of single women to the IVF program, and that's just that they're being rigorous. One of the things in that research that was interesting, it said, as long as there is a man somewhere in the upbringing of a child, like a grandfather or an uncle, so that as long as there is some pattern of extended family, there is no reason why IVF couldn't be open to women by themselves. It became a big issue, and I got booed onto the platform, and I got clapped off the platform because they suddenly discovered I was going to support the legislation. So there are tricky questions. There was a lot of debate about that at that time.
So you found yourself representing the gospel by way of who you are, what you've done, and titles and so forth, even when you've engaged in these committees and community processes and at some stage on global conflict issues and advocacy for people like refugees. All of that a really interesting story. It's not my story. They're not the risks that I've taken, and people here have got their stories. Yep. So I'm interested to round this out of Paul's example and your stories to say, you know, some of our neighbours who don't go to church, so for you and me listening to Alan talk today, I presume that many of my neighbours, and certainly when I talk to and engage with some of the people that I'm meeting through the week, they have a fairly distorted view, or at least it's a diluted view of the gospel of Jesus, or of what a Christian is like, or what discipleship is, or what faith is about. Sometimes they have a really strongly opposed view to something that's a wrong presumption, or sometimes, sadly, they have good reasons not to go anywhere near it, given the terrible misdemeanors you talked about. What should the church be doing? We began this way, stop talking on that, but for those who are sitting there going, my neighbours have got some obstacles before I even start, what do you think we should be doing?
A difficulty is that Australia is becoming progressively, irresistibly secular, and it makes some conversations quite hard to have. That's why sometimes action is better, with explanation later, rather than just talking. The church is so good at talking. It is a problem now in our environment, because people are denying to Christians any right to talk or engage in advocacy groups and so on. I'm currently reading Justin Welby's new book, Reimagining Britain. And there's a whole chapter in there that's very helpful around page 82 about how 80% of the world are religious, but our progressively secular Western culture, using the UK as the example, doesn't acknowledge that that is how the world is. And that you can still read the pages of the book about the prodigal son, how the prodigal son keeps coming up in conversations. There are these main parables, the Good Samaritan and another, that people still recognise. There's a residual Christian culture which we can build on and use some of these parables or modernise the use of these parables so that we shouldn't assume that there's always a negative response to everything. And in Australia, though our secularity is accelerating, parents are still sending their children to Catholic schools. They haven't diminished. There are still opportunities to take part in public debate, no matter how you do it. But the activity, the practical thing, is becoming increasingly important. So I've got two stories. This is my ending thing, isn't it? You are to the same place, I must say. Just checking. Two local stories that relate to this. I go every morning for my health. I go for a long walk up to the shops and then sit down and have a latte, of course, in Crescent Hill, because it's what you do. Just like I had to practice how to dress up this morning. I wasn't sure if I could dress down enough. So I'm in the habit of going to one shop there regularly and buying things, as well as getting the aged newspaper to see if I've got a letter in. So I say to this guy, says to me, he knows I'm in a retirement village now. So he says to me, what do you do now? Now you're retired. I say, I write books. And he said, oh, that's interesting. So the next day, I type up my latest book, Dancing with Angels, the biography of the Archbishop of Burma. I take that up and give him a copy. He says, oh, that's terrific. I'll read it tonight. I thought, oh yeah, he's a busy man, he's running a whole business here in Princeton Hill, he's going to be too busy. I got up the third morning and he said, I read the book, I really enjoyed it. I said, good grief, how did you do that? He said, oh, I knock off at 1 o'clock because I start at 4 in the morning, and so I've got time in the afternoon to read a book. Okay. He said, but I've got one really big question for you. Oh, I'm thinking, oh, this is big. He said, yeah, it's a really big question I've got and I need your answer to it. And I'm pausing because this is my moment. And he says, can you please tell me the difference between an archbishop and an archdeacon? And I've got to think quick, because this poor man in Burma, you know, he's been in jail and he's been in prison and he's... But that's the question. So, really quickly, to take the question seriously, I said, when I tell you the difference, archbishops do all the talking and archdeacons do all the work. And he said, that's what it's like in my shop. He said, I do all the talking and these other fellows do all the work. So we sorted that one out. But the other story is the opposite expectation. I'm involved from the village in an oral history project that BCAL students do from Fitzroy High School. And we've done this twice, and it's a really interesting program. And so I'm being interviewed and get someone a story down. And this young man says to me, and he wants to make this a bit of a feature in his history, he says to me, why did you ever leave journalism to become a minister? Uh-huh. So, well, that was the beginning of the conversation. So it's the opposite result to the other story. So you never know how one thing leads to another and what the opportunities are.
The two things that kind of correlate to what we heard in 2 Corinthians 10 of Paul, and why I could tell some of those stories and to talk about his own engagement with people and politics at various levels, is that Paul talks about weapons on a battlefield of mind and heart that are different to the ways of the world that he saw in those biblical apostles. And the two key weapons that are in the passage we read this morning, I think, are that meekness and humility you see in verse 1, 2, 3, 6, 10, and it is expressed throughout the letter, where you saw in the video clip, though he could put all his credentials forward, he says something like this, that I'm Alan from Fitzroy, and I write to you, instead of reeling off all the other stuff, because he sees in the principle of Jesus someone who became a servant, not a master over people in that worldly way. And the second one being that Paul had experience, personal experience of relying on God's grace through Jesus Christ in the trenches, in sacrificial service, in contexts of the mind and the heart in the real world, relying on Jesus. His faith was, if you like, the other weapon testified to in real stories of life. And that's something we've heard this morning. And so that's something that you and I can take away, ponder, reflect on about how we live this week. Meekness and humility that Jesus wants in us and produces in us as we allow the Spirit to work. And the testimony of the life of God's grace in real life, in real action, taking real risks, including St. Alan, taking testimony.